Well, this week I am so very excited on the Stanford Psychology Podcast to be talking with one of our fellow hosts. Hey, Joe, how's it going?
Hello, Eric. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so this is part of our special series on Meet the Hosts. Who the hell are we to be talking to you every week and to be interviewing all these guests? And, you know, what's our background? Why are we doing this? What got us interested in psychology? What's going on? And I was thinking, where should I start? I have so many questions for Joe, but there's really only one question, which is, can you please tell us about this exciting life change that is awaiting you and what you're doing at Stanford now? And then what's coming next for you?
Right. So first of all, this is so awesome that I get to be one of the guests at this wonderful, wonderful podcast. So if people did not already know this from following me on Twitter, I officially accepted an offer to be a grad student at Johns Hopkins with Professor Sherry Liu, and she is setting up her lab, so I'll be the very first graduate student in this lab. And I mean, I am completely still speechless. I still try to like pinch myself every day that I'm going to be a grad student. So yeah, this is like the big exciting news for me. I'm going to be working with infants. So it's a cognitive development lab. And the general focus of the lab is infants' psychological reasoning and their physical reasoning and their common sense understanding of objects and agents. And I think, so Sherry's expertise is, it's amazing. So she has worked in cognitive neuroscience. She has a lot of experience imaging little infants and also adults through fMRI, MRI, and so on. But during her grad school, she worked a lot on behavioral studies with infants as well. So she brings this like really, really wonderful expertise of combining behavioral studies with a little bit of modeling and also a little bit of neuroimaging as well. So yeah, I'm going to be moving to Baltimore later this month, and I'm just like super, super excited to start this new journey. So with respect to, I guess, what I've been doing and how that's going to sort of transition into what I do in my grad school at Stanford for the past couple of years, actually, I've been here for 3 years, which is like such a long time. But so I have been working with Toby Gerstenberg and Hyo Guan, and one of the projects we did was just looking at children's physical reasoning and particularly their ability to integrate multimodal information in order to make a causal inference about a physical event that happened. And so that was interesting that I sort of got to learn about how children reason in this particular domain of like physical objects interacting with each other. And then after that, I did a second project looking at how children reason about the minds of conversational AI agents like Alexa and Siri. So we kind of studied sort of how children's reasoning about these agents draws from their social domain reasoning, which also is like this entirely interesting like other domain of things that I'm interested in, is like how does, you know, social domain reasoning relate to how children reason in general. And then when I go into grad school, I'm going to be sort of combining these two branches of inquiry, which is like how do children reason about objects and how do they reason about, you know, agents, and how does their reasoning in these two domains sort of interact with each other? Do you rely on your reasoning about objects to reason about agents and vice versa? And there's reasons to think that sort of the capacities involved in reasoning in these two domains are interrelated in some way. Yeah, so this is like generally what I hope to study in my grad school. I think there's going to be a lot of work into figuring out like what are the particular projects I'm going to be working on. But yeah, all in all, it's like a very exciting, daunting, scary enterprise. I just don't have any words to describe it other than just like pure thrill, I guess.
And it seems like it's going to be a pretty smooth transition in your research interests. I know sometimes people have lab manager or research assistant or whatever their position is after college, and then they go to grad school and they're like, now I'm doing something completely different. I've studied infants. Now I do like whales. I want to do something completely different, huge shift in my life. But it seems like you really care about this topic, and so you want to keep doing some version of it with some new input and keep working on similar stuff.
Yeah. I think the big transition would be that I've been working with toddlers and children, so children ages 3 upwards up to like 12, 15, early teens. And when I go to grad school, I'll primarily be working with infants. So that's got to be interesting to like transition, because like infants are just like a whole different ball game. Like the methods we use to study them, you have to rely on measures like where they reach or where they look. The inferences you're making are in some sense much richer, but also require like stronger justifications and better study designs. So that's going to be the one big difference with what I've been doing in the past. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I have so much respect for developmental psychologists, because you really, really, really have to get your methods straight. And the rest of us have the same pressure, but we can just pretend more easily that we just give people a survey and they just say what they think, and we just take that at face value. But with infants, that's rough. And you were mentioning in your grad school lab, there's even fMRI research going on infants, which I know more and more people are doing that kind of stuff. Adults can't even lie still in an fMRI scanner, but infants, I don't even know how you guys are doing that. That's incredible.
Yeah. Oh, wow. The stories I hear about what it takes to do an fMRI study with infants. Let's just say it's understandable why there are not that many fMRI infant labs in this country. And I think there's sort of these limitations of the technological limitations that we have. So yeah, fMRI machines, like you say, require someone to be still, yet people have to do these studies with infants who are awake. And so you essentially have to, what I would imagine, stay with the child for long enough that they calm down and stop moving. And it's not that the whole time you're not doing anything with them, it's that you're actually still recording them so that they get used to being in this like giant loud machine around them. And then eventually, I guess they habituate to that and then they calm down. But yeah, you can imagine how long it takes to just collect a single data set. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for people who have sort of pioneered this line of work. And yeah, hopefully with better like technological advancements in the future, it's going to be a much easier thing to do. But currently, it's intense.
Wow. Well, that's very exciting. Before we lose you to the East Coast, why did you join this podcast? This is a question I've been wanting to ask you for all the time. You've been here. You and Bella have been supporting this podcast, have been hosts for the podcast almost since the beginning, when we had no listeners. And yet, of all the exciting things you could have been doing here at this department, you spent some time on this podcast. So thank you. And why?
Oh, yeah. That's a wonderful question. Interestingly, I think this started as early as primary school and then high school as well. So I watched a lot of YouTube growing up. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time on YouTube. And luckily, there were a lot of good science channels on YouTube. So like Vsauce, Veritasium, mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of these mm-hmm. science channels, but they just would make these wonderful video essays on something. I really liked the space ones. I think one of my favorite Vsauce videos is called like Messages from to the Future or something like that. And they just talk about all these different probes you've sent out to space with information about what humanity is, with the hope that some interstellar beings will intercept it and be like, oh yeah, let's go pay a visit to the humans. So I would just like to consume information that's been really well curated. And I guess the video format was good, and the sort of video explainer format was better than this sort of long jargony papers or something. And so that's kind of what got me into consuming science information. And when I got into college is when I got into podcasts. So I used to work at the library as a librarian, and I would be shelving books in the library stacks for hours on end. It was like a very slow job, and you could pop on some headphones and just listen to some music as you go along. And so I started listening to some philosophy podcasts. I think my favorite ones were Philosophize This. And the interesting thing about, you know, this philosophy podcast is the hosts themselves, I just admired how well they were able to take these really, really complicated philosophical concepts. I mean, I had also taken some few philosophy classes, and for the life of me, just completely failed to understand what the philosophers were writing, even though I recognized that this stuff was very interesting. And I was like, why do they have to write in such a jargony, convoluted way? I don't understand why I have to present this information this way. And I think I was smart enough to know that it's not that I am too dumb to understand it, but that it's just not being communicated to me in the right way. So when I found podcasts that were good at explaining things to me, I held on to that. I was like, oh, wow, it's not about my being dumb. It's just about someone not explaining something correctly enough to me. Mm-hmm. And so from then on, so, you know, I'll listen to not just philosophy podcasts. There were some, you know, general lifestyle. I listened to like the BBC Radio 4, I think like Drunken History, Free Economics. So lots of like general knowledge podcasts. But I also liked it when you could sort of have these like more casual conversations, but then they would sort of pepper in some interesting academic ideas. So yeah, so then I just was like, okay, podcasts are awesome. It's wonderful, especially for distilling some really complex idea through, I guess, verbal communication. Also the fact that if there's someone interviewing someone else, they could ask questions. That's the one thing. Like often when I listen to something that's just one person explaining, I'm like, well, what does that mean that you just said? Or can you elaborate on this one thing? And obviously, because it's a video, you just have no opportunity to do that. But with podcasts, you're like, oh my God, I'm so glad that podcast host asked that question, because that's exactly what I was also thinking. Mm-hmm. And so it's this sort of like you're actively engaged in synthesizing the information that's being presented to you because you're doing it vicariously through the host of the podcast. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, though, this thing began happening where, like, I'm listening to a podcast and I have a question. The podcast asks a question, but it's not quite what I was interested in. And I'm like, damn, it would be so nice if I could interrupt at this point and have the person respond to me. And so, well, actually, this might be an interesting idea for a podcast. It would not work at all. But imagine that you're just, like, talking and it's a live podcast. And then the guest could just interrupt you with a question. I mean, this is like a terrible idea, but basically this is my fantasy. I was like, I just want to be able to interrupt whenever I want and have the guy actively respond to my question and clarify what they said or elaborate more on something. So because of that, I've just always thought that if there was an opportunity to ever be in a podcast or ever host one, I would really enjoy that because I love asking questions. And yeah, and so when I started working at Stanford, I got this email that there's a department podcast, and I checked it out and it was amazing. And yeah, so I reached out and I have been very happily a co-host since. And it's one of the best decisions that I ever made, because at the time that I joined, I was thinking about going to graduate school, but I wasn't sure because I hadn't majored in psychology in undergrad and I wasn't sure how much I knew about the field. And so yeah, I just needed some kind of exposure. And this was like a perfect opportunity for me to not just actively be listening to what other people are talking about, but also to reach out to someone. And it's very interesting. So the research that you do before a podcast episode, I think for me initially, I would over-prepare. But it was very interesting to just learn about all these different lines of work that are going on. And particularly having to talk to someone imposes this constraint that forces you to understand it enough that you can talk to someone or ask questions about the things you haven't understood. So that was just like wonderful. And I don't really know if I would have gone into grad school, to be honest, if I hadn't participated in this whole podcast thing, not going to lie. So yeah, thank you for starting this really like awesome thing that's in many ways like changed my life. So yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you for sharing all that. Do you think, so I used to be really shy. Like I used to be the kid who was like looking at a playground, and if there was one other kid, I was like, I'm not going there. I want the entire thing to myself. I don't want to interact with people. I'm very nervous, very shy. I'm still dealing with that a little bit, but it's gotten a lot better. And I feel like this podcast has helped, because every time you're like, who am I to reach out to this person? Why would they respond to me? Why would they take the time to be on our podcast? And it's going to be so awkward, and they're going to be mean, and they're going to be like, oh, act all powerful against this like lowly grad student that I am or whatever. But like every time this theory is just disproven, and people are just surprisingly nice. First of all, is that something that you find with the guests? And then do you think it has any like transferable skills in terms of just like approaching people, which is really helpful in academia and connecting with people?
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting how much confidence it instills in you, because you're like, wow, I guess if this person has time for me, then, you know, maybe I have something interesting to say to people. So yeah, hosting the podcast and then talking to these academics who I'm like totally in awe of, I think it gives yourself actual evidence that you're having an interaction and the interaction is not going as bad as you had predicted. And so you're sort of updating your belief in your ability to have good conversations mm-hmm. without things mm-hmm. going absolutely bad. So yeah, I wish this was an opportunity that more people had access to, is just to actually literally meet and ask questions to people who would be intimidating to them otherwise, at least like particularly people in academia. It's kind of the same effect as, you know, when you go to a conference. And for me, I went to my first ever conference last year mm-hmm. and just like meeting with these professors who are just, I'm like completely in awe of, and I'm like, oh wow, they're just like chatting with me normally, and they think that the questions and ideas that I have are interesting, and I'm like, how could they possibly think that? I guess that just means that I definitely have interesting things to say.
And I think and I think a lot of us in academia struggle with any sort of level of confidence in ourselves and in our ability, especially if we maybe don't come from a, you know, rich, whatever, Harvard-trained family background, but are international students or first generation, low income. So many things going on that can make you feel like you don't belong and you don't deserve to talk to these people. Now, you have a background that's very unique. You were born and raised in Kenya, if I'm not wrongly informed. Is that, I imagine that must impact how you think about psychology, about your journey. Was that a very smooth transition when you were coming to the US and starting to learn about people and becoming an academic? That must have been quite the transition.
How did you know that? Good research. Yeah, you know, there's lots of things that are like very obviously different about being in an entirely different country. Like when I, you know, when I first came to the US, I was like, oh my God, it's so green and so clean. And we have a bus schedule that you can look up and know exactly when the bus is going to show up. You know, back in Kenya, you would just, you know, just show up to the bus stop and the bus may or may not show up. You don't actually know. The public transport system usually has like a bus with a conductor in the bus. And they're usually like announcing loudly the direction that the bus is taking. And you sort of have to have this little conversation with them. Oh yeah, are you going to stop here, there? And then there's like little cultural things here and there, like people having all these extended conversations about things they experienced as children. And you're just like, oh yeah, what movie is that? What song is that? Like, I totally don't know what you're talking about. But anyway, so when I came to the US and I totally did not know what I wanted to do with my life. It's interesting, in Kenya, there was no such thing as cognitive science, which is the field I'm in right now. And so when I was thinking about what I wanted to do, when you think that you're interested in people, and I guess, let's say you've gotten good grades through your high school, the thing that you study is you're going to medicine, right? People often went directly to medical school. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to do something medical related. Obviously, when I came here, I was just like, the experience in the US was just like so insanely complex and tumultuous and also wonderful in many ways. And then gradually, I guess by the time I graduated college, I realized that like something about development and cognitive science was interesting. I was actually kind of interested in trying to do this in Kenya because I had not been at home for so long, and I just thought that it'd be so interesting. But then I looked into it and there's absolutely no cognitive science research going on in Kenya. So I guess the natural direction was to just keep staying in the US. Yeah, and it's, yeah, and so I've been there till today, and I'm kind of still reflecting on what are the differences and what are the possible ways I can integrate my strong desire to do something that's in some sense connected to the discussions I wanted to study in Kenya. But yeah, up to today, even though I've been in the US for so long, it's interesting that your identity keeps getting formed constantly, because you have my Kenyan-ness and then this kind of American-ness. And I don't know whether you ever get to a point, I guess for people who are sort of in multiple cultures, whether you ever get to a point where you're like, okay, this is my kind of stable identity that influences everything that I do, from my research interests to the future goals that I have and so on. So yeah, it's something that I'm kind of still working through. Yeah. I would imagine it's kind of similar for you. I don't know, because I know you grew up in Germany, right?
Yeah. Which the cultural difference to the US, of course, is much less intense than to Kenya, I imagine. But I still get the feeling of like, no matter what you're doing it wrong. If you are becoming more American because you try to fit in here, then my German family calls me out for it. It's like, well, you're very American now. But then my American friends are like, you're the most German person I've ever met, because I'm the only German person they've ever met. And so I wonder, like, we talk so much in research about, you know, our research is so weird, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic. I cannot even imagine coming from Kenya. Do you just look at a lot of psychology research and say, well, that's interesting, but I cannot relate to that? Do you find that you can relate to a surprising amount of it? How much do you feel like identified with the findings you see produced in more Western weird cultures and contexts?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. So it's fascinating just how similar humans are, you know, across cultures. Like, the commonalities are actually quite beautiful in some sense. So, you know, these are sort of more fundamental, like you might say, behavioral regularities. And these are questions that are asked in all cultures, even though I would say in Kenya, we didn't necessarily have written philosophy. This is actually one of the big interests that I have, is studying kind of like the philosophical conceptions of people in Kenya, people in Africa. But anyway, so people always ask questions about what is the meaning of life and try to construct their own versions of what they think is meaningful, but sort of in this philosophically reflective way. And there's a Kenyan researcher who tried to bring people into the lab, I guess in a more Western style, and write down their philosophies in the way that the sort of the ancient Greeks had written down philosophies. But that's just like an attempt to sort of make it like, I guess, intelligible to a Western audience, let's say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there were remarkable universals. But then at the same time, one of the fields that I dabbled in for a while was moral psychology, which I'm still very fascinated by. And one of the things in moral psychology is political psychology stuff, because I was interested in like out-group and in-group bias, because in Kenya, we have tribalism, which is such a polarizing influence in our elections and so on. But then I come here and the moral psychologists, the fundamental way that they sort of divide people is that you're Democrat or a liberal. And they've tied it to all these other constructs, all these biological things. You have all these intuitions from birth. And I'm like, seriously, like, we don't even have Democrats and Republicans. Sorry, did I say Democrats and liberals? Democrats and Republicans in Kenya. And so this is a very sort of American way of thinking about things. So there are little things like that. And also, you know, the fact that when any kind of research is done on populations that are not Western, the scope of generalization is restricted to only that population. Like, this is all about how the economic decisions are made by the whatever hunter-gatherer tribe. But then if it's studied on a Western population, then it's like, oh, this is how people tend to think. You know, the generalization is made to all humans. And yeah, I guess it partially makes sense that a lot of the research is being done here. And so like a lot of it will be about like Western populations and so on. But people weren't really aware that this was seeping into their assumptions about the generality of their findings. And which is why I was really fascinated to start reading about those people who are in science reform, and they're trying to make more explicit the fact that we should be aware of the populations we're studying and the scope of our generalizations and so on and so forth. Yeah, and it's something I kind of still struggle with. I'm interested in studying cognitive psychology, which I think cognitive scientists tend to focus on what they might conceive of as universal phenomena, like memory, attention. And there are some findings that demonstrate that these things aren't as universal as were formerly thought to be, mm-hmm. and that it might be important to study like the cultural variation that characterizes them. Yeah, and also for me, I honestly have no idea to what extent the common sense reasoning in infants that I'm going to be studying in grad school is, or, you know, who knows how generalizable that will be. So yeah, it's something that I also struggle with, and it's hard to overcome that because the entire institution of science makes it hard for you to be more cautious with the way that you form your generalizations. And in order to change your behavior, you kind of need to have a sort of more collective behavioral change by other researchers. Yeah.
In an economy where there's no jobs to begin with for anyone. So we're running up against time, but this is so cool. And I know you will never forget your background, and in your research, it will always inform it. So that's cannot wait to see all the stuff you're going to publish and it's going to come out of it. But I also wanted to give you a last chance just to add anything. And we've covered so many things and I've been completely all over the place. So I'm sorry, but that was super interesting. And yeah, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're all good. I also give really long responses, I've noticed. But yeah, did you say you want to give me a last chance to say something?
Absolutely. Yeah, say whatever you want. This is your chance.
Yeah, no. Yeah, thank you, Eric. You are the person that started this podcast. Obviously, the rest of the team as well. Angie, Bella, Kate. It's been such a wonderful journey. I hope that I can continue to talk to people and interview people. And I'm also just completely blown away that people found our podcast interesting at all. Yeah, I think it's kind of a beautiful thing because like it goes to show that things that you think are trivial are more shared by people than you would think they are. So yeah, so grateful to all our listeners and I hope you can keep going. I think that this is exactly what society needs. Yeah.
Yeah, and on the note of bringing psychology to the whole world, we and our team like to joke about how our podcast, according to some statistics we are fed, has reached 210 countries on this planet, which we don't have that many countries. So it seems like people around the world are listening, including some people in other galaxies. Who knows? But it's really fun. And so shout out to all our listeners from Kenya and all sorts of other places who feel like a lot of their psych findings are not relatable to them. And so hopefully we can do a better job as a discipline in the future. And I'm sure you will be a leading force, no pressure, of the movement. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Eric.